It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day, and Iowa is pretty famous for our strong, gusty winds, often coming from the west. A healthy row of trees and shrubs on the western side of your property can make a world of difference when it comes to erosion control, keeping the dust down, and other quality of life issues. We're going to start the hour off today talking about establishing a windbreak, and with me is Iowa State University Extension Forester Jesse Randall. Hello, Jesse.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron is going to join us in a few minutes to answer questions. But let's start with, I talked about some of the reasons, but why think about planting a windbreak?
Well, you're right. We're blessed with wind here in Iowa. And windbreaks can serve more than just controlling wind. We can look at a windbreak as an edible windbreak, so we can put trees and shrubs where we can get some food value, either for ourselves. And more importantly, it creates great wildlife habitat out there on Iowa's landscape. And so from the thermal savings, you can put it around your home and really reduce your home heating cost in the wintertime. You can put that around livestock facilities and increase your feed efficiency because the cattle or the hogs don't have to work so hard to stay warm. And so there's a lot of benefits outside of just controlling snow and wind.
And I mentioned planting trees and shrubs on the western side of your property. Should you also think about other areas?
Absolutely. You know, on our place when we moved here in Iowa, we weren't ready for the wind,
it was an
abrupt welcome that first winter, and then we quickly found that the north and the west side is really key to having a good windbreak. But we can also look at wind or windbreaks as an odor reduction strategy. And there you're going to look at the south side. And it's really the time of the year that you're trying to protect. If we look at wintertime, the winds are out of the northwest. That summertime, you're looking more of the south-southwest. So you really, each individual spot is going to be a little unique.
So you're saying if you're close to a livestock production facility, that might be something to consider for odor control.
Correct.
All right. So if you're thinking about the protection, the insulation mm-hmm. for your barn, for your house, for your property, how far away from the house would you want a windbreak to be?
You know, my great extension answer always is it depends. And it depends on how much ground and how many rows of trees and shrubs you're willing to plant. The more trees you have, the more shrubs you have, the closer you can have that inside row to your home. The fewer number of trees, let's say we have two rows of conifers and one row of shrubs, you need to stay 50 to 75 feet away from that building because you're going to have more snow filter through that windbreak. So again, it all depends on how many tree and shrub rows you're willing to put in.
How many tree and shrub rows do you need for a windbreak to be effective?
I'm going to use the minimum of one row of shrubs and two rows of conifers. Now, that's quite a bit of space. You're looking at about 75 feet just in the tree rows. And so if you don't have that with our current spacing guidelines, you can, I hate to say, violate those rules and plant closer to your house. You can plant the trees denser than we normally recommend, with the complete understanding that windbreak will not last as long as one that uses the proper spacing guidelines.
Okay, so if you plant too close together, those trees just aren't going to live as long.
And, you know, we're living with that history right now. When you drive around Iowa and you see some of those windbreaks that are just getting to the point where they are functioning really well now, they're reducing the wind and they're filtering the snow out, you're starting to see disease issues in some of our conifers. And those trees, unfortunately, 20 years ago were planted just too close. We wanted to create almost an impenetrable forest, not realizing what we were setting ourselves up for with the disease aspect of that.
Well, and of course, there are lots of diseases that have spread through Iowa that really weren't anticipated at that point. So blue spruce used to be a really common tree planted in windbreaks. What kinds of conifers do you recommend now?
Boy, Richard and I were just talking about that before we went on the air, and it's getting awfully shallow. That list is dwindling because of the loss of blue spruce, because of the disease now being transitioned into Black Hill spruce. I'm very careful about what we plant. You know, kind of we've switched over to our bread and butter tree now is a Norway spruce. I really like Concolor fir, but it has some pretty specific soil requirements. They don't like heavy, wet feet. I like arborvitae, northern white cedars. They do well. They can be planted denser, and that's one of those trees I like to use when I have a smaller area and have to plant those trees closer together. I also like, I hate to say it, red cedar in certain parts of the state. Again, your outside row, those red cedars can take a lot of wind. They can take a lot of ice damage. They don't always look the best, and that's why I say keep them as far away from the house as possible and hide them behind other nice-looking conifers.
I kind of love red cedars, so maybe that's the Iowan in me. But, I mean, those are actually native trees to Iowa, right?
They are. They are. And they do well. They're kind of a compact tree. Wildlife can get up in underneath them. They really do stop snow and shut the wind down quite well.
Now, you mentioned arborvitae, and often those are shorter, more compact. I mean, we're talking kind of about two different kinds of windbreaks, aren't we? If we're looking at a big farm acreage, the larger conifers make sense. I mean, if we're thinking about something on a smaller property, do you want to think smaller?
Well, you know, you have a few guidelines, and what we try to do is keep the windbreak if you look at how a windbreak works, your most important area to be in. So if your house is in a location, you need to be within 5H of the tallest tree. So five times the height of the tallest tree. And so, yes, height really does matter if you're farther away from your home. I like to think of a windbreak as gradually increasing in height. So I'll have a shorter shrub on the north side, and then the next row in is going to be a little taller, like a red cedar. And then the next row might be a little taller, being a Concolor fir. And then the inside row is my tallest tree. So what I'm trying to do is make the wind go up and over that windbreak as much as it's going through the windbreak. And so my tallest trees I always put on the inside, like a Norway spruce or a Concolor fir or a white pine.
Interesting. And I've seen many windbreaks that are constructed in just the reverse order.
Correct. And you know, it's by the county, and a lot of times you'll have, you know, NRCS, FSA folks go out and lay out plans. I will put a shrub row on the inside, mainly for aesthetic reasons, and as a catch-all, that final dump of snow. But again, I prefer to put my shrubs on the outside.
All right. And I was just going to ask you about aesthetics, because there's certainly utility to a windbreak, but windbreaks can also be very beautiful. So let's say you want a windbreak and you want something pretty, and you know, you're thinking about something smaller. Maybe you're not a farmer or have a large property like that, but you want something to kind of protect your house, your yard. What are your shrubs that you really like?
You know, we're seeing a lot of folks use viburnums and flowering shrubs. Anything that produces a nice berry will not only have a nice flower, or could potentially have a nice flower, but also have some edible uses towards the end of the summer. And so, you know, our viburnums are, we can use a lilac. You're not going to get anything out of that for food-wise.
No, but you get quite a lot out of it.
You get quite a lot out of it. Yeah, I have to throw that in. My grandmother loved lilacs. So,
And they do grow quite dense, so
they
really can be effective, right?
You know, and that brings up another point. What we're seeing in some of these maturing windbreaks, I don't want to call them older windbreaks, but maturing windbreaks, we're seeing the shrubs struggle right now. We're seeing some dieback in our shrubs, and that's across the board. The ones that have the showy flowers, the ones that are more like the red osier dogwoods. What I've come to realize is we have to manage those shrubs on a pruning cycle. We need to be able to go in and take out that older material and rejuvenate the younger stands. One, being younger and faster growing, it's going to be healthier. It's going to be able to fight off insect and disease. And so we can't look at our shrubs as just plant them and walk away for 20 or 30 years and not expect them to have some issues.
Now, let's say you have a windbreak that is having issues. Going into a windbreak and planting new stuff is really challenging because you can't plant too close to an established tree. What do you do to rehabilitate an old windbreak?
I get that question all the time, and it's incredibly difficult. Let's say you plant a conifer in an area where some conifers have died, but you have very big, tall trees around them. The conifers that you've just planted don't really get the sense that they should fill out, and they kind of grow up because the light is limiting. And then when those other trees need to be replaced, you have a tall, spindly tree that isn't going to work right. And so when we work with folks that have a windbreak that needs some renovation, we first explore the option of planting newer rows either inside, if they have the room between the old windbreak and the homestead, or to the outside of it, establishing new shrubs and one row of new conifers. It makes it really hard because we can't really plant, you know, in a piecemeal fashion. We almost have to stick with row planting so those trees all develop at the same time, at the same rate, under the same conditions.
So you might have to tear out what's there.
Yeah, you might have to. And you know, I was just up in Grundy County last night at a windbreak workshop, and folks brought out pictures, and we really come down to which rows are the worst rows right now that we can take out and put a new row in, get them established for 8 to 10 years, knowing that the other rows in that time are going to start to fail, and then we move down through those rows. And there are programs through FSA and NRCS to renovate windbreaks. There's cost share money available at your county offices to renovate old windbreaks and to put in new windbreaks.
All right. Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Iowa State University Extension Forester Jesse Randall is here. ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Duran will be joining us in just a moment. And you are welcome to join the show, too. 866-780-9100 is the number to call with your questions about any of the plants or trees in your life. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Iowa State University Extension Forester Jesse Randall. We've been talking about planting windbreaks, but Jesse can answer all of your tree questions. And also, Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Duran is also here. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And you are welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we're going to get to some calls in just a moment. We've got phone lines open for you, 866-780-9100. Jesse, I want to circle back to something that you mentioned just a couple of minutes ago about the idea of planting a windbreak that's also a part of an edible landscape. And I know that's something people are really interested in right now. What are some of the shrubs that you find to be most useful in that kind of windbreak?
Sure. You know, I like to use aronia berries. You can have that. There's various cultivars out there that you can get. You're going to have to do a little bit more protection. You know, deer and rabbits kind of like those plants, but there's a plant that provides copious amounts of fruit. I really like elderberry. The one caution there is the birds are, if you're not right, if you don't time your harvest correctly, the birds are going to eat a lot of it. And those berries go into a bird purple and come out purple. So if you have a white car, you got to be real careful. What else do I like? Hazelnuts. If you have the right soils, there are some new selections of hazelnuts. And even if you don't get an improved cultivar, just a native hazelnut will do well. You may not get a lot of those nuts. The squirrels and the mice and the chipmunks probably will get them before you. But again, that's not always a bad thing.
Right. You mentioned creating habitat, mm-hmm. and obviously you're supporting wildlife and pollinators. You're going to have a lot more birds to watch and enjoy, so it could be positive even if you don't get your harvest, right?
Sure. And in our windbreak and in our shrub plantings, I very rarely get anything other than the enjoyment of knowing the wildlife has got a meal.
All right. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And, Richard, we had a warm period. We had a cold snap. Mm-hmm. We had some snow. Mm-hmm.
It's Iowa.
Yes. You predicted it. Clairvoyant, as always. Now, if looking around right now, do you think that slowed things down? Are we getting back to a more normal spring emergence?
Yeah, definitely slowed things down. We're still maybe 10 days or so ahead of normal, but things have slowed down. We are starting to see some flowers on, for example, carnelian cherry dogwood, forsythia. So we're starting to see some flowering. So I would say about 10 days ahead of normal.
All right. And hopefully we'll all keep our fingers crossed that when the fruit trees mm-hmm. flower, that we won't have a terrible frost after that. But that is still a real risk, given
it
that
is.
We're 10
yes.
days ahead.
Yes.
All right. Let's get to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Yana is on the line in Boone. Hi, Yana.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. What's your question?
Yes, we are facing this issue right now. We are in central Boone County. I wanted to see what the gentleman thought about the fast-growing willows.
For a windbreak?
Yes.
Well, I can tell you that I have those hybrid willows. They live fast. They die young. As a new property owner, we were faced with not having a good windbreak, and we wanted something immediately. And so we got those. We put them in. We put them ours are planted every 4 feet, which is really close. And they grew great. And then by year 7, we started to see some canker, and those trees were beginning to die, partly because of mm-hmm. the stress of being planted too close. And so we had to regenerate those, and we cut them off. And within a year, they were back to about 12 to 15 feet tall. I don't think they're going to live through another maybe one or two cutting cycles before I have to think of something else. But it creates an immediate windbreak. They use those a lot around hog confinements and cattle lots, because even though they lose their leaves in the wintertime, they have such a dense branch structure, if they've been coppiced and cut off and resprouted, that they really do shut a good portion of the wind down, not like a conifer, but they do well.
Okay, very good. Would you recommend one or two rows, or one row as a protection to an additional row that's more slowly growing?
I would have those faster growing ones only one row, and then start to put in something that's slower growing, more permanent, that's going to be longer lived and provide more of a wintertime wind reduction, like a conifer row.
So maybe the conifer on the inside or the outside?
That's how I have mine. My conifers are on the inside.
Oh, perfect. Thank you so much.
All right, Yana, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number. Chelsea's on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Chelsea.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question isn't about windbreak, but we have a large sycamore tree in our backyard that, after that warm spell we had in February, the bark has started to fall off in large chunks. And probably about half of the tree has lost its bark, and now the under part of the tree is exposed. And we just bought the house a year ago, but I don't think this is normal activity, and we aren't really sure what to do.
Well, there's two possibilities. It is normal for the sycamore to shed the outer layers of bark. That's a very common occurrence. And when it does so, there's still bark beneath it. They just lose the outer layers. And when they do that, typically the underlayers are white, so you have that white color.
Okay.
The other occasion would be if the actual bark is coming off all the way down to the wood. That would be obviously...
That's what's happening.
Okay. Well, that's obviously not a good thing. On the other hand, there's really nothing you can do to help the tree deal with that. For example, painting it does not do any good. Painting the exposed wood with like a pruning paint, whatever, does no good. So basically, you just monitor the situation. And as long as the wood is still solid, that's a good thing. If it begins to rot, obviously, then the issue becomes, well, it's no longer structurally sound. And if it's close to a building or some other structure, you may have to consider possibly taking it down.
Okay, there is some darkness. So there is some white, but then there's also some spots of darkness. I wouldn't call them black, but to me it doesn't look like its natural color.
Okay.
So,
I would go out and kind of wrap it with your knuckles and see what sound you get. Definitely when it's rotting, you get kind of a hollow sound. If you get more of a solid sound, that's a good thing. But just monitor it, and if you start to notice some rotting, then the issue becomes, is it structurally safe?
Okay, that's good to know. I just wasn't sure if it had some type of disease or something like that, so I'm glad to know it's somewhat normal.
All right, Chelsea, thanks a lot for your call.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you, guys. Have a nice day.
866-780-9100 is the number to call. And Jesse, you said you hated to recommend the red cedar. Here's an email from Jerry who hates that you recommended the red cedar. He says, terrible choice for a windbreak. Anyone growing apples within a mile will curse you. Also, what about white pine? Fast-growing, beautiful trees.
Well, I feel the gentleman's pain with the apples.
And what's the relationship there?
Well, there is cedar apple rust. And so that disease spends its summer months on your apples, on your apple leaves and on the apples themselves, and then spends the fall and winter overwintering on red cedars. And yeah, if it's within a mile, but if you look around, there's almost always a few red cedars within a mile. And so we normally now just face the fact that we have to, if we want good apples and healthy trees, we're going to have to treat those trees. It's not a function.
And there are cultivars that are apple scab resistant and cedar apple rust resistant. So you have that option.
Yeah. And the older varieties, you're not going to get that. But, yeah, if we're switching over our orchards to more of the resistant varieties, so.
All right. Here's a question from Brett, also on the subject of fruit trees. He says, I live in the floodplain and would like to have fruit trees. We've had cherries and plums in the past, but they were killed by the floods. Any recommendation for water-hardy fruit trees?
Boy, I don't think there is such a thing. Your fruit trees as a group, your apples, your pears, your plums, your cherries, they basically insist on a well-drained soil. They just do not like wet, poorly drained sites. I can't think of a good fruit tree that's going to do well in a wet, poorly drained situation.
All right. How about trees that love that kind of situation?
Well, there are trees that do well in floodplains. Everything from river birch to sycamore to some of the maples, but typically not fruit trees.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Mike is on the line in Newell. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Great. What's your question?
Well, I'm glad we're on the subject of fruit trees because I have some apples. I brought a property about 2 years ago, so I don't know how old they are, and I don't think they've ever been really cared for. And you can tell there's apples and then there's also some plums and they're starting to kind of die off and not doing real well. Is there anything I can do to bring them back, like aggressive pruning or treat them with something, or should I just, you know, replant?
Well, how would you describe their condition? Are they like half dead or?
Yeah, it seems like it. Some of the apples are, you know, have certain branches that are dying off and the production has been going down. They didn't produce at all last year.
Okay. I guess if the tree is more than half dead, I would probably start over. If you have a tree where maybe 25% is dead, I would just simply go out there and cut out the dead wood and see what it does this coming year. And if it seems to maybe come back a little bit, produce well, then fine, I'll keep it. But I'd probably give it a year to recover and see what it does. And if you do replant, then I would look for dwarf and semi-dwarf trees because they're easier to manage. They also begin to bear fruit much sooner than standard trees. So look for these dwarf or semi-dwarf.
All right, Mike, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100. Next up, we've got Lewis in Linn County. Hi, Lewis.
Hello. Good morning.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, what's your question?
Well, my question has to do is I gave up a house with oak trees for a house with ash trees, and I have a significant number of them dying. How do you get rid of the ash trees? Can they be taken down and taken to, like Linn County has a lawn waste and recycling area? Will the boar still be alive, or once the tree's down, will it be okay to take it there?
That is a great question. All right, Richard, let's say you've got emerald ash borer and you're taking the trees down.
I would refer that to Jesse and see.
Okay, Jesse, that's where I meant to throw that one.
Yeah.
Your favorite subject.
Yay. You know, emerald ash borer can complete its life cycle in wood materials as long as the bark is on it. Once the tree's been down and dead and dried, the bug isn't going to come back to it and complete another life cycle there. So when you have it taken down, you either A, put it into a pile and burn it immediately. You can bury it. You can chip it into very small chips and compost those chips. I would not, though, let it stand and go through the process of dying, which takes several years because you allow the bug to go through its life cycle for several more years. So if you know you have EAB and the tree is dying and you're not treating, take it down and destroy it. So bury it, burn it, don't let it go through another cycle.
All right. Now, when I was living in Michigan, they were going through the onslaught of the emerald ash borer, and the common wisdom at that time was that it needed to be, the wood needed to be chipped, and the chips needed to be smaller than 2 inches. Is that still considered to be something that works to control the emerald ash borer, or was that just a good try?
It'll work. I want to say 1 inch. When in doubt, make them smaller. But you also don't have to chip the entire tree. If you have the log of that tree and you take off the outer inch or two of wood where that larvae is primarily living, you don't have to chip the whole thing. But all of the branches, anything with bark on it needs to be chipped.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Jim is on the line in Strawberry Point. Hi, Jim. Jim,
oops.
Yep, are you there? What's your question?
I'm here.
All right.
My question is, like some input on what I've already done, I guess. And what I did is I planted Miscanthus gianticus to the north of my grove, probably about 14 feet away from the grove, because the grove was starting to lose its pine and then arborvitae. First, there's several rows of pine that are planted too close, and then arborvitae that the deer have chewed off the bottom. And in an effort to plug the bottom of the grove, I was just wondering if this is a good idea or a bad idea. I planted about 3-4 rows on 36-inch centers, and it's probably 80 feet long. And I'd like your commentator's input.
Well, it's a very tall grass. It's very dense. It does a pretty good job substituting for a shrub. So in that regard, it's fine. It grows perfectly fine in Iowa, so there's no hardiness issue there. So I think it's okay.
Okay, I was just wondering if that was a good idea or a bad one.
And to my knowledge, it's not invasive, so that's not a problem either. So that's good.
All right, so good news. Jim, thanks a lot for your call. We've got another windbreak question. This one's from Paul in Ely. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning, everybody. I've got a question about my beautiful, very, very old blue spruces in the back of my property. I have 11 that were planted, we think, probably in 1988. So they're very tall and very stately. But unfortunately, over the last couple of years, they've experienced a lot of needle drop on the bottom half and bottom quarter of most of them. I'm assuming it's that needle drop fungal infection. I've trimmed the trees that are the worst affected, probably a quarter of the way up to provide some air movement. I guess my question is, should I just cut them down and start over, or might I have any opportunity to save some of the healthier trees from that needle drop?
Well, I guess I'll take this one. If that were mine, I would, if I had ground, I would start new trees near those or another row, because we're not going to stop it. There are treatments. They're costly, and they're, you know, 3 to 4 times per growing season in the early spring, annually. And so eventually it gets to the point where you just can't treat. So start a tree now, because you will in the long term lose those trees.
All right. Sorry about the bad news. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment to continue Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa with me, ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Duran and ISU Extension forester Jesse Randall. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and we are here to answer your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Iowa State University Extension forester Jesse Randall, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran, and let's go back to the phones. Lots of fruit tree questions today. Kurt is on the line in Indianola. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Good. What's your question?
I have a grove of around 6, I think now I'm down to 4 cherry trees.
Okay.
And about every year, I lose another cherry tree, and they start to exhibit this, it almost looks like clear silicone caulk or an amber-colored gelatin that just starts coming out at around the crotches of the branches, mm-hmm. and kind of a fungal growth. And these are, you know, a small pie variety cherry, and I would say they're about 14 to 15 years old. And I'm just wondering, is that a life cycle issue for those, or am I fighting a fungus that I'm not addressing, or what might issue do I have there?
That's basically gamosis, and that's pretty common on your stone fruits, your cherries, your plums. Any type of injury might cause those things to form, those balls of sap. So that isn't exactly very definitive as far as why they're forming. A few is pretty common. As far as their lifespan, cherry trees tend to be fairly short-lived. I would say typically maybe 25, 30 years at most. Make sure that they're in a well-drained soil. That's critical for them. They just hate wet soils. Depending on their age, maybe they have reached maturity and maybe they're starting to decline.
All right, and then as far as pruning those cherry trees, what's the best tactic on that? What's the recommendation there?
I think for the most part, they have a very good form on their own for the most part. So typically, if you have something like a North Star or a Meteor, those are dwarf or semi-dwarf cherry trees. They typically develop a good form on their own. The only thing I would do is to have a kind of nice clearance on them. Beyond that, they kind of form a kind of ball. Very, very well on their own.
All right. Well, I appreciate the information.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Kurt. Next up, we've got Joe in Fredericksburg. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. I have a trumpet vine that has gotten too tall and is climbing all over my grandchildren's playset. Is this the time of year I can trim that back? And if so, how aggressively can I do that?
You can prune it back aggressively. No problem. It's hard to kill, so don't worry about that. And you can prune it anytime you need to. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
They are resilient
plants.
It's
tough. Don't worry about it.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Joe. Mark is on the line in Ames. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good morning, everyone. My question is about a fungal turf infection that I had in my lawn last year. It was diagnosed through ISU here in Ames. And I'm wondering, it's pretty extensive die-off. Now, if I go to reseed this spring, do I need to, am I fighting an uphill battle on that? Do I need to treat it with a fungicide before I plant seed?
Right. We rarely use fungicides in a landscape situation. We really don't use those very often. They're not very effective.
Okay.
normally what we try to do is maybe change the environment somewhat and make it less favorable for the disease. Now, last summer, we had a very wet summer, and I think that was a factor in the occurrence of the disease. So hopefully that's not going to reoccur. As far as reseeding, do you have a fairly good lawn right now, or is it very, very thin?
No, it's good. It just has, you know, patches that are, you know, 5 feet by 10 feet along the driveway and around the perimeter of the yard that are gone.
Okay. Because reseeding is kind of difficult. What I would suggest on these dead spots, to go ahead and go to your garden center and buy a starter lawn fertilizer that contains a special pre-emergent herbicide that will prevent the germination of crabgrass seed, but allow the turfgrass seed to germinate. So you need that special one, because most pre-emergents will not do that. They'll kill everything. So make sure you have a starter fertilizer and this pre-emergent, and use that and then reseed those areas. On the rest of the yard, on the rest of the yard, I would tend to apply just the standard pre-emergent fertilizer combination.
All right. I pretty much leave that up to my lawn care company.
Okay. Okay. And as far as fertilization...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
As far as fertilization, one thing that some people do that's a mistake is they fertilize, let's say, during the summer months when the grass really doesn't want to grow very much. And if you fertilize during the summer months, you produce a very, very lush growth, which tends to be much more prone to disease. So definitely try to avoid fertilizing in June, July, and August. And when you fertilize in the spring, make sure it's not a heavy application.
All right, so let your lawn take a little bit of a break in the summer, and everybody might benefit.
Right.
All right, Mark, thanks a lot for your call. Let's do a few Twitter questions here. This one's from Hannah. I have lilacs that bloomed like crazy 2 years ago, but last year we had nothing. Can I look forward to blossoms this year?
I would hope so. You should. Now, unless you prune sometime after, let's say, mid-June of last year, because if you pruned after mid-June, you may have pruned off the flower buds, and they may not bloom this year. But if you didn't, they should bloom this year, yes.
All right, here's a question from David. Are galvanized containers safe for a backyard garden?
Galvanized containers.
So I'm guessing
good
steel?
Question. Yes. I would think so, but I'm not sure on that. Now, one thing, whenever you're growing things in containers, there has to be holes in the bottom. There has to be drainage of some type. So if they use something like that, they typically do want to make sure there's holes in the bottom. They might want to use a plastic bucket instead, possibly, and just drill some quarter-size holes in the bottom.
All right, and I decided to try a little Google search to see what it said, and there are lots and lots of gardening containers that are made of galvanized steel that are being sold. So I didn't find anything definitive that says that they're not good for your garden, but clearly a lot of people think they're okay.
That's a good sign.
Yeah. All right, here's a question from Kelly. Is there a way to identify apple type from the tree and fruit? A 40-year-old tree produces the best apples, but what type?
Right. That is difficult. To do that, you basically need ripe, mature fruit, and they have to be unblemished or undamaged, because as far as IDing it, you need to see the color and the shape. Those are the best indicators of as far as the variety. So you have to have two or three good fruit, mature fruit, and then possibly we can have somebody identify it. Now, as far as the tree itself is concerned, you can actually propagate that by whip or tongue grafting, where you don't need to know the variety. You can reproduce that tree with a graft.
All right. So you can have the fruit even if you don't know what to call it.
Right.
All
right. A new tree.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Patty is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Patty.
I'm so glad I need a visual block to block the light from a strip mall 2 blocks away. I'm going to put green giant arborvitaes in. Can I just cut holes in my patio, you know, square holes, and put the trees in those holes, or should I cut off a chunk of the patio?
Oh, so you want to plant them, like, in your deck, actually.
You have, like, a rock patio or a cement patio? Is that it?
A cement patio.
Okay.
Yeah. No, that's not a very good situation. You don't want to put them in holes in confined areas like that. They're not going to do very well. So they really need to be beyond the patio or something of that nature.
How much room does a green giant arborvitae take, and how fast will it grow?
Well, it's going to get to be fairly big, and so both height-wise and width-wise, so you don't want it very close. You want to give it plenty of room to grow. It could easily get to be 15, 20 feet tall, easily.
How far away from the fence should I plant it in my garage?
I would say probably at least 5 feet, more likely probably 10 feet from the house or the structure.
Okay, how fast will it grow?
Well, it kind of depends upon soil conditions, weather factors, but it can grow fairly fast, maybe a year, or maybe a foot or more in a year.
Okay, thank you so much. I appreciate your help.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Patty. And she's looking for a light block. So what about putting up trellises, that kind of thing?
That's a possibility, or maybe some of the other arborvitae. There are other arborvitae that are much more narrow in size. And so they might look, for example, at holmstrup, which is one that's very, 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 very narrow, typically doesn't get beyond maybe 3 or 4 feet in width, and might top out at maybe 10 to 12 feet. So there are some smaller varieties that might fit the job much better.
All right. Let's do a couple more email questions here from Laura. Would it be realistic to try to transplant a young 6 to 7 foot oak out of a flower bed? If so, would this upcoming weekend be appropriate?
I would give it a try. You want to typically do it when it is dormant, and I would try to move it with a nice ball of dirt around the actual root system. So maybe a 2 to 3 foot diameter soil ball, and try to keep that intact.
All right. And since we've had this little cold spell, maybe she'll be all right.
And keep it well watered this spring and summer. And if it does well this summer, that's a good sign.
All right. Here's a question from Matt. I'm removing a large soft maple, looking to replace it with an ornamental dogwood. What type should I look at in frozen Mason City?
A dogwood for frozen Mason City. Not too many options there. As far as a tree, there is the cornelian cherry dogwood, which is kind of a small tree, large shrub, kind of depending on how you look at it. But we have some on campus here at Iowa State. It is currently blooming. The flowers are not nearly as showy as the flowering dogwood, but it does quite well. It has small little yellow flowers in the little balls or clusters. It does produce fruit that are edible, but if you don't eat them, the birds will. So I'd look at the cornelian cherry dogwood as a possibility. The other possibility would be a pagoda dogwood, which is native to eastern Iowa. It kind of likes partial shade, but it tends to be a kind of a fat tree or shrub, typically wider than tall, maybe 15, 20 feet tall, maybe 20 feet wide. And so you could look at pagoda dogwood also.
All right. Well, good luck with that. Here's a question from Brad in Cedar Falls. I have two wild blueberry plants, Rubel and Friendship, planted in containers. There is a tall cane coming out of the base of the plant on each plant. Is that a sucker? Do blueberries have suckers? I'm not sure if I should prune that off or let it grow.
It is a shoot. I wouldn't call it really a sucker. And they're not actually wild. Those are cultivars. I would probably cut it back so it's more size with the rest of the plant. So kind of cut it back some, but don't remove it completely.
All right. Here's one from Mike and Milo. I have an existing windbreak that's made mostly of thorny trees, honey locust, and hedge. Would like to remove some and replace with other trees. The area is wet as the fields to the north drain through it. Any recommendations?
Well, actually, it gives me a great segue. We have a new windbreak application. If you just Google ISU Forestry Extension, we created a program. It allows you to go in and find your location, identify where you want a windbreak, and it will look at your soils through NRCS's database and it will link that to the DNR's Woodland Suitability Index, and it will tell you what trees are going to grow, what trees, what shrubs, what conifers will grow on your site, and it will lay it out. It will tell you how many of each you need and give you a rough estimate on what the cost of replanting will be. So we've taken all of the guesswork out of not knowing exactly what your soils are, not knowing exactly what your drainage are, you know, over the phone, and allow you to do that on your own.
Okay, so it's an ISU Forestry Extension app. So if you just look for that, you'll find it?
Yep, it's right on our main homepage. It says new windbreak application, and it's about 3 inches down from the very top of the main welcome page that you find.
Okay, terrific. Let's go back to the phones. Keith in Wyoming. Hi, Keith.
Hi, good morning. See, I'm transplanting some balsam fir from one property to another. They're in the 6 foot to 10 foot range. And I was just wondering what is recommended for successful growth for these trees.
As far
and then
as.
I have another question, too.
Okay, as far as the care or.
Yeah, I mean, like, obviously, we'll dig the hole. Where I'm planting them is in clay soil. I was just wondering if, you know, once I dig the hole, do I put some nice black soil?
Nope. Don't add anything to the soil. I would try to use a tree spade if I could. And as far as planting them, do not add anything to the existing soil. And make sure they're planted a little bit on the high side if it's a clay soil. Make sure they're not planted too deeply. And then after that, just make sure that you keep the soil ball wet for the first few weeks, water frequently, and then less frequently through the summer. But make sure they're not planted too deeply. They should be a little bit on the high side in a clay soil. And do not add anything to the actual soil, like compost or whatever.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Keith. And we're nearly out of time, but let me ask you, Jesse, before we go, we've got a couple of people asking about guidelines for windbreaks in urban and suburban settings with smaller lots. Where can people find information about that?
Again, we created that application to work across a variety of sites. You know, we will allow them to select a one all the way to five row windbreak. So it really does work for those small ownerships. And again, you can go in and look at the tree, and it will tell you what the spacing is, what the height will be on those, so you can select smaller size tree and shrubs.
All right, and I'll slip this in really fast. Scott in Norwalk says, I know fall's the best time to plant grass feed, but I'm not patient enough to wait that long. So can I do it in the spring, and when?
If you do this spring, I would shoot for mid-April.
And
you may get more weeds than grass, unfortunately.
All right, so wait for fall, but if you can't. Thank you so much for being here today, Richard Duran.
You're welcome.
And thank you, Jesse Randall.
Thank you.
Iowa State University Extension Forester Jesse Randall, ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Duran. We will be back again next Friday with Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.